Hey, friend. Really proud of this Portfolio Career podcast episode with Howard Gray. Howard is a venture builder, educator, and coach based in New York City, originally from London. You can head over to howardgray.net to quickly learn about his many projects and more. So here we go. Excited for you to build and grow your portfolio career here with Howard. Okay, cool. Welcome to Portfolio Career Podcast. Your host, David Nabinsky, is here with Howard Gray. How's it going, Howard?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's an honor. It's an honor. So, Howard, if we were to go to an event tonight, how do you typically introduce yourself?
So probably like quite a few of the previous guests you've had on the podcast, it varies depending on audience, and it's probably something that many people kind of struggle with. I guess the way I put it generally is I would call myself self-employed. I work for myself. I'm an educator, I'm a coach, and a project builder. So I love to build projects, and I have a particular focus on helping people build ideas, ventures, and careers. I'm really interested in the world of work. And kind of as a slight kind of subtext to that, I'm really interested in making traditional content and traditional concepts kind of more culturally interesting and culturally relevant. So that's how I would introduce myself. But it depends on who's in the room.
Okay. And one thing I've been really fascinated by was a recent blog post that you had about, you know, things you've learned 1 year moving to New York. So I'd love to learn a little bit, you know, about that here in terms of how you think about work in New York and navigating New York compared to London.
It's a great question. So yeah, I wrote that post a couple of months ago. So I moved to New York in September 2017. So at the time of recording, we're about a year, coming up to my year and a half anniversary. I don't get a gift for that, unfortunately. Year and a half is not really an anniversary of sorts. So yeah, I moved here just under a year and a half ago. And yeah, working in the city has been, it's been really interesting. I've learned tons. Some of the things that probably came out is I believe like New Yorkers get this reputation of being sort of really blunt and really kind of to the point, and everything's sort of moving really, really quickly, and everyone's just trying to get from A to B, which I think is generally true. But I think what a lot of people miss is that a lot of people here really want to help. And whether you're in like startup world, tech world, whether you're in like the media business, I mean, all sorts of different industries from my perspective, it seems that people are really keen to help out. If you have an idea, they're not going to tear it down. They're going to be curious about how you can make it happen. They're not necessarily going to say like, yeah, that's a great idea, but they're always curious about how could you put the wheels in motion. And then that usually leads to people often saying, oh, here's somebody you should talk to about that idea who could help you move it along. So I found that to be maybe a little surprising, you know, coming from a different culture and having this kind of preconception of what New York is and being here a few times just on brief trips. Living here, I definitely realized that very much came out as people really love to see things moving and putting wheels in motion. So that was one of like the big takeaways from my first year here.
What would be a great way for somebody, if they wanted to, let's say, a new event or, you know, start a new blog, what would be a good way to start to find that niche tribe?
So I think events are tough. Like I personally am quite introverted, so I actually find events like quite hard. A concept that I really love, the kind of idea of the impresario, which is a kind of older word, I think it's Italian, and I suppose when you think about that word now, it probably comes to mind like the big, loud, colorful, extroverted kind of circus ringmaster, right, type thing. But the impresario is actually more of a producer or curator than necessarily a promoter. And I suppose there's kind of the producer and promoter part of like event stuff. So I find like the production side easier, I find the promotion side harder. So I guess to your point about somebody who wants to get started, I think it's good to recognize which of those come more easily to you. Maybe it's both. Some people are really brilliant at kind of the details and the organizing, and also are really great promoters and connectors and networkers. So I think if you are both of those, fantastic. If you recognize that maybe you find it harder to kind of be making loads and loads of quick connections, or you find it harder on the detail stuff, partner up with someone. I know we've talked before offline about being a useful resource to people who have already got one or two of those different skill sets can be a really good way to get moving. If it comes to that for events, I think that's a great way to start, is find stuff that's already interesting, that's maybe quite nascent, so not the biggest event in town, but what's something that's kind of small, quite interesting, and maybe there's a skill set you've got that you can add to what they already have. And I think that starts with recognizing what your own strengths are and being okay with that. Like, I know that I'm not the best promoter in the world. That's okay. So I try where I can to partner up with those who are. When it comes to starting a blog, for example, someone asked me about this a few weeks ago. There's a bunch of different kind of mindsets and different ways of thinking about this. A couple of friends of mine definitely go down the route of they like to write longer form, like 2,000-3,000 word posts once every few weeks or something like that. Very kind of industry specific, kind of thought leader way of approaching it. My way is slightly different. The way that I'm currently set up is I post, probably not quite daily, but trying to, kind of little snippets, like just little sort of bits that I think are interesting. They're usually like 1 minute reads, just some sort of like pithy little thing that I saw on the street or something.
They are interesting.
Yeah. I think they're interesting. So I guess to that point, it's like I do write these little things and I write some slightly longer things. But the little short things I find are just, that's the practice. So just by putting out little things and not really worrying too much about what happens to them, that as a blog practice, that has been really helpful for me. I found morning pages really helpful. So for listeners that don't know, there's a book by Julia Cameron called The Artist's Way. One of the main concepts of that book is around this idea of morning pages. And morning pages are basically three pages of, we've both got notebooks in front of us, three notebook pages. Your notebook is slightly larger than mine, so this will take you longer. Three notebook pages of just whatever's on your mind in the morning. Wake up in the morning, just write three pages. I cheat because, as you can see, David, my handwriting's really bad. So I do mine on Evernote. So I use a digital version. But I try and write, it's about 750 words it comes out as. I find I can get to like 400, 500 pretty easily. 750 is hard, like to do that every day. But the idea of the morning pages is just come whatever comes to mind. Doesn't matter what, it's not structured, anything like that. The interesting thing for me that's come out of that is that while I write, sometimes it's a more sort of journal type writing, sometimes it's kind of more abstract stuff. I found that a lot of ideas for blogging have come out of just like my sort of morning brain dump, stuff that I didn't think. I was just writing about the day yesterday or what's in my kitchen or whatever. And suddenly little kind of small bits that can become blog posts, little small catalysts for ideas seem to come out of the morning pages. That's been really interesting. So I will often just like copy two sentences, stick that into my blogging software that I use, and then maybe try and flesh that out into something of a post length of, even if it's just like a couple of hundred words. So I guess maybe my advice for somebody who wants to start blogging, there's loads of different ways. I think just write is a good start. Even if it's private, like you don't even need to like publish it under your own name. You don't need to like tell everybody about it. So even like the morning pages technique can be a really good way of doing it. And just something that you are curious or interested in. You don't need to be and try and be a thought leader about a particular industry. That I think a lot of people try and go that way first rather than just writing. I think just writing is a really good way of getting started. So I found morning pages. I've only been doing morning pages recently, last like month or so. I've been blogging a lot longer than that. But I've definitely found that, yeah, those little insights, little snippets that I can get from coming from the morning pages seems to be a really great way of getting a blog going. So I'd be fascinated for someone who's new to blogging whether that method can help them with getting going.
Interesting. Mm. And I think another one of your blog posts had been around this, the concept of the hyphen and skills as opposed to, you know, a capitalized title and stuff. So I'd love to dive a little bit deeper into that in terms of with the portfolio career lens, in terms of what lowercase and hyphens and what that all means to you.
So like a lot of my ideas, I wouldn't say I stole it, but I remixed it. So my friend Tom Critchlow, who's also another Brit in New York, there are quite a few of us. Tom is a really talented marketer, really talented blogger. He writes a lot more like long form stuff, so he's really great writing long form stuff particularly. He wrote a post about a year ago, and as an aside, I actually discovered him through his blogging, so that's another good reason to blog. He wrote a blog post called Small B Blogging, which was all about writing about very kind of specific niche kind of areas with a small B, rather than trying to kind of change the world. Rather like the concept in startups of putting a dent in the universe rather than kind of trying to, you know, take over the world, I suppose. So that kind of like small B approach. So I really like that post. And like with all wonderful ideas, I did absolutely nothing with it for about 6 months. I just kind of had it in my brain. And I can't remember how I got to this concept, but I just kind of, I think from a lot of my other work of being kind of partly generalist, a hyphenate, as some people, you know, whatever the kind of terms you use around people that have got a kind of bunch of different skill sets, I kind of stumbled upon this idea of like this small b blogging or lowercase blogging. I thought was quite interesting around the lowercase skills. So, for example, I can use Sketch, I can use Photoshop, I can code. None of them particularly well, but I can do what I need to do in Sketch. I can produce like podcast artwork, I can produce like half decent websites, I can create digital assets that I need, stuff like that. I'm not a UI designer by any stretch of the imagination, but I have the fundamentals of Sketch or Photoshop or Ruby on Rails and a bunch of other stuff. So rather than them being kind of capitalized like I'm a designer or I'm a developer, it's like, well, I'm kind of like a lowercase version of that. Like, I wouldn't ever call myself a designer. Kind of like being a podcaster. Like, I don't call myself a podcaster as such, not what I do for a job, but like I do podcasts, so I'm probably a lowercase podcaster. So I kind of love this idea of like these lowercase skills that I think many of us have, and they can just come from hobby side projects, you know, whether it's lowercase blogging. Tom wrote about it regarding like the sort of subject matter where you're going into a very sort of specific area. But I think it also applies to the skill set as well. So the idea of lowercase skills being you don't just do one thing. You can have a kind of, you may have a capital in one thing, but like a lowercase in a bunch of other. I think where it differs from like the T-shaped people concept is that the T-shaped thing is usually those are things that you are using all the time. Mm-hmm. They're usually within your role. You have that long kind of part of the T that's the main job title, and then there's four or five things that are kind of also very important to the work that you're doing. Lowercase skills don't necessarily need to be like that. Just like, okay, I know how to use, we were talking about podcasting technology before we started recording. Neither of us profess to be audio engineering experts. We both know our way around how to record and edit and publish podcasts. So I think there's lots of different skills that you can kind of switch on, switch off, build up a bit, make dormant for a while, turn back up again. So yeah, I found that really interesting. And my belief is that's going to become more important, and I think it connects into the first question you ask, and you ask all your guests about how do you introduce yourself. You know, I think a lot of the guests on this podcast probably have a lot of lowercase skills, as in they have to utilize different skill sets for in different contexts with different roles within the portfolio they're working in. So yeah, I'm really interested in that concept. It's a blog post and a couple of other little bits for now, but I'm interested to see kind of as I keep thinking about it and doing more things like this and meeting more people with this kind of interest and skill set, where the concept may go.
Yeah. I think it really resonated with me when you think about that LinkedIn title, you know?
Yeah,
That's where it particularly really stands out in terms of just putting all those little lowercase ones there.
Yeah.
But I loved it. I thought it was fascinating. And, you know, especially as, you know, you're spending a lot of time in education right now. So that's another reason why I think it's really interesting in terms of, you know, where we're moving towards or where we are. Another thing on LinkedIn is really interesting, how you have kind of three areas of focus of things that you're working on. I'd love to learn like how you decided those are your focuses and how you try to kind of blend them together.
So a note about LinkedIn. I have friends that work with LinkedIn, so I shouldn't be hating on LinkedIn too. And I do use it all the time. But an interesting kind of aside about LinkedIn is like the projects, and we're talking about Portfolio Career Podcast right now, the projects on LinkedIn always go to the bottom. So like I've got a bunch of projects and they're all at the bottom. It's like no one goes down that far. So so it's actually weird that mentoring and like volunteer work and projects, LinkedIn stacks them below education and your work history. So that logic says that the job you did when you were 17, whatever your first job is that you put on the site, is more important than the most recent project you've just worked on or the most recent mentoring experience. I'm not going to rant about LinkedIn, but I think the way, if you want to look at kind of the shifting landscape of work in this podcast and LinkedIn and kind of linear careers and everything else, if you look at the fact that LinkedIn stacks your profile in that order, I think that says a lot about who it's built for and maybe who it's currently not built for. So I get quite frustrated that like my podcast has to like sit right at the bottom. And I mean, I can put it in like my work history thing, but like it's kind of not that. It's not really a work history, it's not really a job. So it goes in the projects, but it's like stacked right at the bottom. To your point, I don't want to sidebar too much. My profile, because I don't because I don't have a big brand that I work under. And, you know, some of your guests do, some don't. Like, I don't have like a sort of big company thing that I have. I'm me, really. So your automatic LinkedIn headline is, you know, job title at company, right? That's the default setting. My one, I think, is adventure, exploring the intersection of entertainment and education and experiences and entrepreneurship. So there's these kind of four things that start with E. So the education piece, I do a lot of teaching. I really didn't like school or university at all. So that's probably why. Maybe that's why. I'm sure a psychologist have a field day with me. That's probably why I've got into education, maybe. Hmm. So I do a lot of teaching. Maybe we can dig into that in a bit. Some of the stuff that I'm doing there. The live experience, I'm really fascinated by. Despite being an introvert, I love great live stuff. And I'm also really interested in kind of and we were chatting about this offline a little bit, the balance of in-person versus online, particularly in education. I think that, so that kind of experience, like how do you deliver great online experiences and great offline, and how do you scale that stuff? And I think all of that's super interesting. Entertainment, because I come from the entertainment business originally. Like, I spent about 7 or 8 years running companies in that world, music mainly, but kind of broader entertainment too. And I've been like a movie junkie since I was like 8, so I'm a super geek on IMDb and all that kind of thing. And I guess more broadly around entertainment, I think that there's so much scope to inject great storytelling, tension, narrative, even special effects into education and that kind of experiential education particularly. And I guess the entrepreneurship thing, because I would never call myself a capital letter entrepreneur. I'm pretty also a lowercase entrepreneur, but you know, entrepreneurship is something that's really important to me, doing my own thing. And I think entrepreneurship is really powerful in terms of education, enabling people to do more, you know, creating new value. There's loads of great ways entrepreneurship can be utilized to build skills, build careers, connect people. So those four things of education, experiences, entertainment and entrepreneurship, I'm really interested in that. And they all start with the letter E, which helps. makes it nice. More recently, I've been doing more kind of entrepreneurial education stuff, broadly speaking. But yeah, I try and kind of mix all four together wherever I can, whether that's through like running events or creating content or teaching or whatever it is. So yeah, mm-hmm. those four things like really kind of underpin what I'm about.
And how do you decide on like new projects, right? I think you had a really funny tweet a couple of months ago in terms of, I'm working on so many different things, and going back to LinkedIn in terms of, I can't even really put them
There's
on
no
here
space.
And stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, conversely, obviously, in working on a lot of exciting things, how do you decide on new projects, Howard?
It's hard. So my decision-making process has definitely evolved over time. There's a really great Derek Sivers blog post called Hell Yeah or No. So like basically either say hell yeah or absolutely no. I agree with that to a point, but I think when you're in the uncertainty, when you're in the, you're trying to kind of build stuff, but also earn and everything, you know, all the other things that we need to do, that can be hard to say hell yeah or no. So it's kind of the hell yeah becomes like, yeah, okay. That can be tough.
Mm-hmm.
For me, deciding on stuff, it doesn't need to be aligned to those four E things that I just mentioned, but definitely helps. I think going back to the thing about knowing strengths, about the impresario and all that kind of stuff, I think knowing the strengths helps, like really trying to be as objective as I can about, does this align with like my strengths and what I want to do next or what I want to do longer term? So talking about my blog a lot, I wrote about this post I wrote called The Microscope and the Telescope. And basically the concept is, like when we have anything like a bright light, our eyes will kind of, you know, your eyes will start to kind of hurt when you have to change focus. You know, you look at something bright and then look away and your eyes will kind of shrink up and hurt a little bit as a refocusing. A lot of what we have to do when we're building our own stuff is be able to look microscope in terms of the detail, but like the telescope in terms of that like big view. And that switch can be really hard. So I definitely try and like apply both those kind of viewpoints where possible. Like, where is this going to go long term? What are the kind of specifics I need to do to be able to do this? I know we're both Seth Godin fans. I think Seth Godin's dip concept is really helpful as well. So am I willing? I'll probably butcher the kind of concept, but there will be a dip in this project. The dip being like, it gets boring, it gets hard, no one cares, I don't care, whatever it is. I think I'm much better now at seeing where that dip could appear and being prepared for it, and then thinking, okay, I think the dip will come up at this point. Am I willing to take that pain and struggle that's going to come with it?
Can you speak to an example of that in terms of a dip that you saw in advance coming and then adjusted because of that?
Yeah, I guess one example is probably my own podcast. So I knew there would be a dip after about 6 to 8 episodes. So I did my best to batch to get the first 4. And we were talking about kind of getting podcast episodes recorded and edited. So it's a thing. Like it's not a small piece of work. I worked hard on getting like the first few done, and then I tried my very best to line up episodes sort of through to about 11 or 12 so I could sort of push through the dip, because I had them booked to record. So I was obligated to do it. I didn't want to let myself or the guests down. So I had a sense that the dip would kick in about episode 8 after the kind of novelty had worn off, and I realized that editing was really tough and all that kind of stuff. So I deliberately booked in the episodes and the guests, so it was hard for me to flake, because I didn't want to let myself or them down. So that was like one kind of simple example. But if I was just going one by one by one, it would have been really easy for me to think, oh, I haven't got a guest this week, maybe I'll just pause it, and I just end up dropping out. But by having the kind of full guest list like in advance, where I'd put my name on it and said, look, this guest who I respect, you, I want to interview you, here's the date, they've said, yep, I'm going to give you an hour of my time, I'm obligated, you know, there's some pressure on me to deliver there, and I feel kind of accountable to them. So yeah, that was one where I managed to sort of line them up in advance to help me sort of push through that dip that inevitably came. I think also kind of with the dip thing, I think it's also okay to pause stuff as well. Like, I think a lot of people with projects, it's like, it's okay to press pause. So some stuff will fail outright and you'll say, okay, that didn't work, that's going in the trash. But there's other things that you can pause. So I actually updated my website a couple of days ago with this. Like, there's a couple of projects that have kind of been dormant that I sort of got off the ground, didn't quite work, but I kind of feel like there's something in this still. Like, I don't know when it's going to manifest, but it's on pause. So I just put them up there as being like, these are paused. They may start again. I may press play on them again. And I kind of did that for two reasons, I guess. One, in case someone else gets in touch and says, you know what, I really love this, we should talk about like collaborating on it or something. Secondly, it's just out in the world. So if someone else wanted to grab it, or it gives them some inspiration to something, a catalyst for something that they want to do, great. It's on pause, but it's out in the world. You can borrow the idea and, you know, remix it or change it. So I think when it comes to like choosing projects, knowing the dip has helped a lot. Aligning it with like what I'm trying to do longer term, thinking about the skill set and the strengths that I've got and what I don't have. And when it comes to what I don't have, if I'm not going to bring anyone else in on this, can I do it myself? Is the pain, it kind of connects the dip thing again a bit as well, is can I get away with it? Like if it needs this particular skill set, how important is that skill set? If I don't have that skill set, can I find a way to do it without? Will the project survive? Will it be good enough for the audience without me having that ability? So that's I often think about that. And then, this sort of pausing concept of when I do choose something, it's also know that it is okay to pause it and maybe restart it. There's obviously a challenge there that you don't want to pause play too much. So I try and keep that ratio kind of, I guess, apply the sort of 80-20 rule. I never want to have more than like 20% of projects that have paused. It's always, to use kind of lean startup terminology, like persevere, pivot, kill. So I'll try and like kill stuff where I can, but keep like a couple of things paused at any one time that I think are kind of interesting, or maybe where I was a bit early on or a bit late on or whatever. So yeah, those are a few of the things I use to help me choose what to work on. It is hard. And you know, as humans, we're not good at predicting stuff. We all think we are, but like predicting the future is difficult. So it's hard to know what's going to work. And I think that uncertainty that comes with choosing projects, and I'm talking about kind of personal projects rather than client projects right now, but that uncertainty that comes with doing our own project, that is hard. And like, it's hard to embrace, definitely very hard to embrace. It's hard to even like hold hands with, let alone embrace. So it can be tough when you don't know what's going to happen, If you know that we're not great at estimating and predicting, choosing projects is tough. So I think having a kind of open to experimentation, open to pausing stuff, knowing where the dips come, and knowing about your strengths and alignment, those are some of the things that help me.
Yeah, that's super helpful. Wow. Yeah. I mean, another thing that I really enjoyed from you, and I think it's maybe a good way to better understand, is this really going to work, was you sent me an email recently about a survey in terms of, you know, listening to what I'm interested in, you know, and then and giving you useful, tangible, real insights to help things that you're working on. I thought that was an incredible idea. I think, you know, a lot of times people are really kind of reluctant to ask for people, but something like that was very easy and I knew it'd be helpful. So hopefully it was helpful.
It was absolutely helpful. So yeah, just to give a bit of like context on that, I have like a monthly newsletter thing that I send out, which is kind of an interesting kind of collection. A friend of mine said it's almost like in the library where there's serendipity, or it's filed under miscellaneous where you don't know what you're looking for yet.
Mm.
So that's kind of how I approach it. It doesn't really have a particular theme. It's more just, here's a collection of cool stuff that I can see interesting links between, that read into it what you will. So that's like a monthly kind of compendium of interesting stuff that I saw around these kind of 4E things that I mentioned broadly. And I suppose with regards to that, and then also my broader kind of production work of podcasting and writing and stuff like that, I think it's really important to know like who you're doing stuff for and what they want. Like we often think about that in like startup, you know, business context. But I think it really applies to like any kind of creation.
Mm.
There's definitely kind of outliers to that, or kind of corollaries to that. Like for example, some artists will not be, they're not looking for to know what people want. They just want to go and create art. But I think if you're seeking to kind of provide value to an audience through writing or something, knowing what they want helps. So I sent out a little survey to you and a few other people, and the interesting thing about that was it took me a long time to put together. It was a really simple survey, but the questions that I was asking, it took me ages to figure out, how do I ask this question? So when I send this to David, A, it's easy for him to answer. B, I get as much insight as I can. And like C, its question is like still succinct, concise and relevant. So that I actually found surprisingly hard to put that together. Because I think with surveys, you know, we're all busy. We don't want to answer a 130 question survey from somebody, but maybe like 6 or 7 questions that are quite quick and you can do in 2 minutes. That's usually fine. So yeah, I spent quite a bit of time like trying to craft the questions. I think that's a good lesson, like generally when you're talking to people, is I think for first meetings or coffee chats or whatever, is like the quality of your questions goes a long way. I'm definitely still getting better at asking good questions, but yeah, the art of the question when you want to kind of get as much insight and feedback from people is really important. So I spent a lot of time on that, and yeah, I appreciate you taking the time to feedback, because yeah, it definitely informs like what I'm working on. I can look at click through rates, I can look at open rates, all that kind of stuff, but actually having someone tell me or write back to me about saying, I'm really interested in this, or I'm really struggling with that, suddenly gives a kind of whole different spin on it. So yeah, I try and use that kind of feedback loop wherever I can.
It's interesting you say about working on getting better questions. I clearly am as well. And
aren't we all?
I think maybe at this point I'll turn it over to you a little bit to say, Howard, is there anything else you'd like to talk about some of your work, some of the changes you're seeking to make, some things that you find interesting, lessons learned?
Oh man, so much. So I'm going to try not to like go all over the place. In terms of like useful stuff for people that may be listening and are kind of like on their either on this path or maybe thinking about embarking on it, a couple of just like kind of time management things, if in case it's interesting, is that I really struggle with this. Like it's really hard. I use the Pomodoro technique where I can, which is the red kitchen timer. So the red tomato. I still say tomato, and we're not going to get into British American English. That's a whole podcast on it in its own. Pomodoro technique is basically set a timer for 25 minutes, work on one task for 25 minutes, timer goes off after 25, take a 5-minute break. See how many Pomodoros you can do in a day.
Mm.
Sounds easy. The catch is, if you find yourself getting distracted, you've got to start again.
Mm.
So it's actually really hard to do more than three or four. I've really struggled to do more than three or four in a day. So I try and do like 25 minute batches of like one particular task. This means a bit of advanced planning, but I found that's quite an interesting technique. Something that the writer Daniel Pink, I heard this on another podcast quite recently, around the day. I think a lot of us don't really think about like, when's my most productive time of day? Oh yeah, I'm productive in the morning. We don't, but do we really think about that? And I think with meetings, like meetings can be, if you work on your own, meetings can be a total time killer. Like they are lethal if you don't place them in the right. There's a whole thing about who to meet and why and all the rest of it. But in terms of like the scheduling, that can be like a total day or even week killer. So Daniel Pink says that, you know, I think it varies. There's a few different types, but most people broadly will be good at doing analytical work in the morning. So that's the peak. There'll be a trough, which usually is mid-afternoon, the mid-afternoon lull. And then there is the recovery, which happens after the trough. So for me, that pretty much broadly aligns me. I'd add one more for myself, which is that I find that a lot of kind of creative stuff happens very early in the morning. I think a lot of people have that too. So that's when my morning page is. I'll do them at like 7 in the morning if I can, if I'm up that early. And I find now I'm trying to do my kind of analytical work. So like deep research stuff or maybe like more complex technical stuff. I'll do that in the morning. There will be the inevitable trough. And I often try and fight the trough. And it's hard. And I can find myself getting really like frustrated at that time of day. Like just nothing's really working, feeling very blocked. Like that often between like sort of 2 and 4, I find that's really, for me, is really, really bad. So therefore I try and just do like admin tasks or go for a walk or something else or something that's scheduled that I don't need to think too much about. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. In terms of stuff that I'm interested in right now, the word that I'm really fascinated by is tension. So whether that is like the tension between doing paid work and free work, whether it is being the producer of a project or the actor in a project, whether it's being the principal or being the agent, whether it's time or energy, whether it's, you know, the time of day that you're working in. So I find like also with tension with like fitting in and standing out, I find that really interesting. Like how much do we conform to kind of a group or society or our team that we're working in, how much we're going to stand out. So I think like the tension that we all have in all the kind of aspects of our lives, like tension usually sounds like a bad word. It can be good too. Like we talked about like pushing through, there's definitely tension there. But yeah, I'm really interested in that right now. So I'm focusing quite a lot of writing on like managing the tension that we have, particularly when we're working in like portfolio careers and working on our own a lot. I think there's a lot of that tension between your client work and paid work and what's free and what's paid and all that kind of stuff. So that's something that I'm kind of fascinated about. Bigger thing that I'm really interested in that I would love to, if I can kind of hook it together, I would love to kind of really invest big time, long term, is personalized learning. It's kind of connected to the Daniel Pink thing again about when is a good time. We all learn in different ways. I've been reading some amazing like MIT research on this about the way we process information. I've been doing some classes recently where there haven't, as a student, where there haven't been any visual aids in the room. There've been no slides. I didn't think that'd be a problem, but I found it really hard, really hard. So I had to like draw comic strips for myself to like get myself to understand the concepts because I couldn't listen because I just kept on tuning out. I got very distracted. It was in a big group. And I just found that like, yeah, that for me, my learning style didn't work so well. So both personalizing to learning styles and also personalizing like content. So whether that's cultural references or like topics or the kind of teachers or the experts, whatever it is, that's a really big, like big hairy beast of an area. But I think the like personalized learning, I think, is really interesting. So yeah, I'd love to spend more time on that.
And so when people want to read about this, they can follow you on your website, on Twitter,
your newsletter. I will plug appropriately. My website is howardgray.net, G-R-A-Y.net. I'm on Twitter as Howard Gray. Boring, but it's my own name. I have a newsletter once a month, which I call the Adventures Newsletter, which is sent out once a month. And it's kind of a collection of some of my own work, stuff from other people that I think is interesting, around kind of innovation, entertainment, career fuel, so stuff like to kind of help you on your either a portfolio career path or whether you're working within a company. And yeah, just a kind of interesting curated digest. I try and make kind of as tightly connected as I can. There's usually like a little thread running through it. So I send those out once a month. And yeah, all my projects are on my website. I have a podcast called Tickets, all about kind of education and entertainment. And yeah, I'm threatening to work towards a book at some point. We will see. It may be on lowercase skills, it may be on tension, it may be on personalized learning. We will see, but as I will take my own advice, just write first, rather than say I'm going to write a book. So I am currently just writing. We will see what comes out. So yeah, that's where you can find me. That's what I'm up to.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Howard. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thank you.